You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled From Jesus to Christ. This is Lecture 4. We may perhaps sum up the subject of the last lecture as follows. From the mystery of Golgotha onward, to the beginning of that epoch before the portal of which we now stand, a man could come by various ways, exoterically, to an experience of the Christ impulse, an experience before actual initiation. One of these exoteric ways is through the Gospels, through the New Testament. The contents of the Gospels, when these are received into our souls and permitted to work upon us, actually bring about for each one of us an inner experience. And this inner experience may indeed be called the Christ experience. The second way for the exotericist was described as that of accepting what an esotericist, he who in a certain sense was initiated, could make known from the spiritual worlds. By this way, also, the man who as yet was standing before the gate of initiation could come to the Christ event, not through the traditional gospel, but through continuous revelations from the spiritual worlds. We spoke, too, of a third way, that of the inner deepening of heart and soul, and pointed out that this way must begin in experiences through feeling. For man, if he feels within him only the divine spark, may be driven to pride and arrogance. On the other hand, when he is not conscious of his connection with the divine, he can be driven to despair. We saw how, in very deed, since the events in Palestine, the swaying between despair on the one hand and pride and arrogance on the other has been the cause, if a man fixes his gaze upon those events of Palestine, of the birth of the Christ event within him. It was, then, pointed out that within the next 3,000 years, beginning from our own epoch, everything will be different as regards the evolution of humanity. We also indicated the significant event, which is a consequence of the mystery of Golgotha, but which will be seen spiritually only in the supersensible worlds. Concerning this event, we pointed out that the capacities of man will be enhanced, and that a sufficiently large number of persons, beginning from our epoch, will grow up able to see the Christ. Thus that which so far, justifiably, has existed in the world as faith, will be replaced by what may be called, quote, the vision of Christ, close quote. Now it will be our task in the course of these lectures to demonstrate further that from the usual way of experiencing Christ, as an experience of the heart, the path opens out quite by itself to what may be called the Christian initiation. In the following lectures, we shall speak more exactly about the gradual building up of the Christian initiation. It will also be our task to characterize more closely the nature of the Christ event. Thus, a picture of the Christian initiation and of the Christ event from the baptism by John to the consummation of the mystery of Golgotha, must come before our minds. If up to this point you keep this resume in mind, the following question may arise, and it is quite justified. What is the relation between external Christianity, Christian evolution as it appears in world history, and the Christ event itself? To everyone who stands consciously in the present, who has gone through no special soul experience of a mystic nature, or has perhaps only the preliminary stages of esotericism behind him, it might appear strange that in every human being a quite definite kind of soul experience should be dependent upon an historic fact, the events of Palestine, on Golgotha, and that previously for these human souls something was not possible, which afterward through these events became possible, namely the inner Christ experience. Of these facts, the leaders of the first Christians and also the first Christians generally, had a very distinct consciousness. And in preparation for the next lectures, it will be well to consider a little how these things appeared to the minds of the early Christians. One can easily believe in such belief, turned later more and more to an orthodox, very one-sided view, that human beings of the pre-Christian times were radically different from those of the post-Christian period. That this view is one-sided you can gather from the words of Augustine. He says that that which we now call the Christian religion existed already among the ancients and was not lacking in the beginning of the human race. When Christ appeared in the flesh, the true religion, which was already in existence, received the name of Christian. In the time of Augustine, it was well known that there was not so radical a difference between the pre-Christian and the post-Christian times, as the Orthodox and the Zealots maintained. Justin Martyr, too, makes a quite remarkable deduction in his writings. Justin, who is recognized by the Church as one of the fathers and a martyr, enlarges upon the relation of Socrates and Plato to Christ. With definite clearness, Justin sees in Christ that which we brought forward yesterday in the relation of Christ to Jesus of Nazareth, and in accordance with this, he works out his idea of the Christ being. In his title Apologia, he says, expressing the opinion of his age, what we can repeat today in the same words, Christ or the Logos was incarnated in the man Jesus of Nazareth. Justin then says, did the Logos exist in the eminent personalities of the pre-Christian time? Was man in pre-Christian times quite unacquainted with the Logos? To the first question, Justin Martyr answers yes, and to the second, emphatically, no. Socrates and Plato were also men in whom the Logos lived. They did not, however, possess the Logos completely. But through the Christ event, it has become possible that man can within himself experience the Logos completely in his original perfected form. From such a passage by a recognized father of the Church, we gather in the first place that the early Christians were acquainted with that which, as Augustine says, quote, was always there, close quote, and which only entered into the evolution of the earth in an enhanced form through the mystery of Golgotha. Secondly, we have an answer out of the earliest Christian centuries to the question which we ourselves have raised today. Men like Justin Martyr still stood near to the event of Golgotha and knew much more than men of today about the nature of those who were but a few centuries removed from them, as Plato and Socrates were. Justin Martyr thought that at the time when Socrates lived, although such an eminent man could experience the Logos within himself, he could not experience him within himself quite fully in his most intense form. This, as a witness from these earlier times, is important, vis-à-vis, that looking away for a moment from the event of Golgotha, man felt that something lay between the centuries before and after Christ, whereby pre-Christian men could be distinguished from post-Christian. It can be shown by numerous other instances from history that men in earlier centuries consciously said, quote, human nature has indeed changed. It has acquired another quality, close quote. A man living in the 3rd century after Christ, looking back to those who had lived in the 3rd century before Christ, could say that though in their way the latter could penetrate ever so deeply into the secrets of existence, yet that which could take place in men living after the time of Christ could not have taken place before. Thus that which John the Baptist said, quote, change your outlook on the world, your idea of the world, for the times have become other than they were, close quote. And that which occult science ratifies was also in the first centuries after Christ strongly and intensely felt. It must be grasped quite clearly that if we want to understand human evolution, We must cease to hold the false idea that man has always been as he is today. For apart from the fact that in the Western world one could attach no meaning at that time to the idea of reincarnation, we must gather from all that tradition and occult science shows us that in very early times human beings actually possessed what is now only in subconsciousness, namely a certain power of clairvoyance, that later they descended from the heights of this clairvoyance, and at the lowest point in this descending evolution, when those forces developed which obscured the old clairvoyant powers, lies in the time in which the mystery of Golgotha occurred. In the material sphere, people know that a great quantity of fluid can be affected through an extremely small quantity of a given substance. When you put a drop of some particular substance into a certain fluid, it spreads itself out through this fluid and colors the whole of it. In the material sphere, everyone will understand this. But it is impossible to understand spiritual life unless a principle, which can be so easily understood in a material realm, is not understood in a spiritual sense. Our earth is not merely the material body which our eyes see. Our earth has a spiritual sheath. As we ourselves have an etheric body and an astral body, so has our earth such higher bodies. And just as a small quantity of substance spreads itself out in a fluid, so that which rayed forth spiritually from the act on Golgotha spread itself out in the spiritual atmosphere of the earth, permeated it, and has remained from that time. From that time, therefore, something has been imparted to our earth, which it had not formerly. And since souls do not merely live everywhere enclosed by matter, but are like drops which live in the sea of the earthly spiritual, even so since that time, human beings are embedded in the spiritual atmosphere of our earth, which is permeated by the Christ impulse. That was not the case before the mystery of Golgotha, and it is the great difference between the pre-Christian and the post-Christian life. If a person cannot imagine to himself that such a thing can take place in the spiritual life, he is not yet far enough advanced to grasp Christianity actually as, in quotes, mystic fact, the full meaning of which can only be recognized and acknowledged in the spiritual world. He who looks back over the unedifying disputes concerning the being and personality of Jesus of Nazareth, and the being and individuality of the Christ, will be able to feel everywhere in the secular Gnostic and mystic views of the early centuries of Christianity that the most advanced of those who, at that time, yearned to extend Christianity, stood with reverent awe before these mystic facts of Christianity. We see clearly in the case of those first Christian teachers, even though their words, their sentences are often abstruse, that they stand in reverent awe before all that came to pass for the world's evolution through Christianity, and that they declare again and again that weak human understanding and the weak powers of human feeling and perception are not sufficient to give true expression to the immense significance and depth of that which happened in the mystery of Golgotha. This powerlessness to give real expression to the highest truths man has to touch passes like a magic breath through the first Christian teachings. The reading of such writings is a good lesson for anyone, even in our times. We can learn thereby to exercise a certain modesty with regard to the highest truths. If we have the necessary humility and modesty toward that which is more easily recognized as the portal of a new Christian epoch than it was in the first Christian centuries, we can say, quote, "Certainly it is now possible to know more than it was then, but no one who ventures to speak of the mysteries of Christianity should remain unconscious of the fact that what we are able to say today concerning the deepest truths of human evolution will, in a comparatively short time, again be imperfect. Close quote. And because we wish to come gradually to a deeper characterization of Christianity, we must give special prominence at this very time to man's own bearing in his innermost soul toward the spiritual world, if he himself accepts or wishes to spread abroad the truths which since the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century can stream to us. Thus, even if we do not speak much about the concept of grace, we must make great use of it in practice. Every occultist today clearly understands that this concept of grace must belong to his inner practice of life in a quite special degree. What does this mean? It means that today investigations can be made concerning the deepest truths of Christianity, quite independently of the Gospels and of every tradition. Everything, however, which is connected with a certain thirst for knowledge, with a passion for gaining as quickly as possible a certain number of ideas, will lead, if not into complete error, quite certainly to a distortion of the truth. Whoever says that since he is occultly prepared, he must provide an explanation, for example, of the Pauline epistles or the Gospel of Matthew, how these are to be known in their inner meaning, would quite certainly deceive himself, if he wanted to undertake it, and were to believe that he could complete it by a certain time. In a human way, we can go deeply into these documents, but all that can be known about them cannot be made known today. For there is a golden saying, specially for the occult investigator, quote, "Have patience and wait, not until the truths are grasped by you, but until they come to you." Close quote. Many a person can approach the Pauline epistles feeling himself ready to understand this or that, because in the spiritual world it meets his opened eyes. Should he wish at the same time to understand another passage, perhaps quite close to it, he may not be able to do so. The suppression of the thirst for knowledge is needed today. One should much rather say to oneself, quote, "Grace has brought me to a certain number of truths. I will wait patiently until further truths stream to me." Close quote. Today there is really more need of a certain passive attitude toward these truths than there was perhaps 20 years ago. Footnote, date of lectures, of course, is 1911, end of footnote. But this attitude is necessary, because our minds must first completely ripen in order to allow truths to enter into us in their right form. This is a practical lesson regarding investigation of the spiritual worlds, especially in their relation to the Christ event. It is fundamentally wrong when people think that they can grasp at that which ought to stream toward them in a certain passive way. For of this we must be conscious. We can only be what we ought to be in so far as we are judged worthy of the spiritual powers to be this or that. And all that we can do in meditation, contemplation, and so forth is really done only to open our eyes, not in order to seize the truths which must come to us, truths which we may not run after. With any other feeling than whole-hearted devotion, we cannot enter the spiritual world. Our age is in a certain way ripe, so that those who develop this feeling through passivity in their soul evolution, in the way described above, can understand what has just been said, what we have placed today in the forefront of our subject, vis-à-vis that something like a drop of spiritual substance flowed from the deed upon Golgotha. Souls are ripe today for this understanding. Much that modern times have brought to us, we should not have had if souls had not been willing to ripen in this way. I need only call your attention to one case. If the soul of Richard Wagner had not ripened in a certain passive way, if he had not surmised concerning the mystery of Golgotha the flowing forth of that which came drop by drop into the spiritual atmosphere of earth humanity, we could not have had his Parsifal. We can read this in those passages where Wagner refers to the significance of the blood of Christ. We can find many minds in our day who show us how that which hovers in the atmosphere is grasped by the souls into which it penetrates. And theosophy is here for this reason, that there are many more souls than are actually aware of it who now have the possibility of being able to gather from the spiritual world the influences described above. But such souls need a lightening of their difficulties through the understanding of the spiritual world. In reality, no one whose heart is unripe enters into theosophy. No one who has not more or less a sincere longing to know something of what has just been mentioned. It may indeed be that some are driven into the theosophical movement through curiosity or the like, but those who are impelled to it with upright hearts feel the longing to be able to open their souls toward that which is making ready for the epoch of human evolution, which begins in the present age. People need theosophy today because their souls are becoming different from what they were a short time ago. Just as souls underwent a great change in the period in which the event of Golgotha fell, so will they again experience a great change in this, our millennium, and in the succeeding one. The rise of the theosophical movement is connected with the fact that souls, even if they are not clearly conscious of it, have a dim feeling that something is taking place in this age of ours. For this reason, it is now necessary that within the theosophical movement, a certain explanation of the principles of the Gospels should be begun. And if you can convince yourselves, through inner honest feeling, that there is something true in the Christ event, as it was described in the last lecture, you will find yourselves able to understand what has happened as regards the explanation of the Gospels. You will understand that in the theosophical interpretation of the Gospels, something has been done that differs very much from all other Gospel interpretations, as these have been given in past centuries up to the present. When anyone takes up the courses of our lectures connected with the Gospels, he will see that everywhere a return has been made to true meanings, meanings which can no longer be reached if the present-day Gospel text only is taken as basis. This means nothing less than that from the existing translations of the Gospels we can no longer reach that which the Gospels actually wish to indicate. To a certain extent, as they exist today, they are no longer fully of use. What then has been done toward reaching an explanation of the Christ event, and what must be done? To those who approach the understanding of the Christ event by the path of theosophy, it must be clear that these Gospels were written by men who could look upon the Christ event spiritually, with spiritual eyes, who, therefore, did not wish to write an external biography, but followed the old initiation writings. This connection is shown in greater detail in title Christianity as Mystical Fact. They maintained that what had taken place in the depths of the mysteries had, in the Christ event, occurred on the plane of history, through the divine course of human evolution. Thus that which, on a small scale within the mysteries, had happened to the candidate for initiation, happened to that being whom we call the Christ, upon the great stage of the world's history, without that which, for human beings, was necessary by way of preparation, and without the seclusion of the mysteries. That which previously could only be seen by the eyes of the pupil of the mysteries, in the innermost sanctuary of the mysteries, was enacted before all eyes. This is again something which the first Christian teachers felt with reverential awe. When they considered what the Gospels ought to be, there arose in the genuine Christian teachers the feeling of their own unworthiness, of their own inability to grasp the true meaning of the Gospels. This same fact is the cause of something else connected with the necessity of interpreting the Gospels as we do today within the Theosophical movement. If you have followed the explanations of the Gospels as given here, you will have noticed that what the traditional books of the Gospels give is not in the first place taken as the basis. For that which the traditional books of the Gospels give is regarded as something altogether unreliable. Instead, through the reading of the Akashic records, we are taken back to the spiritual writing as it is given out by those who can themselves read spiritually. Only when in the Akashic records reference is made to some passage given in the Gospels do we take into account the particular explanation of the sentences in the tradition as it stands in the printed books. We then examine whether and how far it agrees with the form which can be gathered from the Akashic records. The Gospels of Matthew, of Mark, and of Luke must be reconstructed in this way, from the Akashic records. It is only the comparison of the tradition with the original form which shows the way in which this or that must be read. Every tradition which rests only upon the letter must cause the reader to go astray and fall into error. In the future, the Gospels must not only be explained, but must first be reconstructed in their true original form. Then, when anyone examines what is there set forth, he can no longer say, well, this may or may not be true. When there is agreement, it will be clear why, for us, it is only the reading in the Akashic records which can guarantee the right text of the Gospels. It will prove where that which stands in the Gospels in the letter is correct. This can be shown in numberless passages. As an example, let us take the following. At the condemnation of Christ Jesus, a question was put to him as to whether he was a king sent from God. And he answered the question with, quote, "Thou sayest it," close quote. Now, if the reader thinks straightforwardly and does not wish to explain the Gospels according to the professorial methods of the present day, he must admit that with this answer of Christ Jesus, no clear sense can be connected as regards either feeling or reason. Taken from the side of feeling, we must ask why Christ Jesus speaks so indefinitely that no one can recognize what he means by saying, quote, "Thou sayest it," close quote. If he means to say, quote, "Thou art right," close quote, there is no meaning in it, for the words of the interrogator are not a declaration but a question. How then can this be an answer full of meaning? Or, taking the matter from the side of reason, how can we think that he whom we imagine to be possessed of all comprehending wisdom should choose such a form for his answer? When, however, these words are given as they stand in the Akashic records, they have quite another sense. For in the Akashic records it is not, quote, "Thou sayest it," close quote, but, quote, "This thou alone mayest give as answer," close quote, which means, when we understand it rightly, quote, "To thy question I should have to give an answer which no one may ever give in reference to himself, but which only he before whom he stands can give as answer. Whether it is true or not true, of that I cannot speak. The acknowledgement of this truth lies not in me, but in thee. Thou must say it. Then and then only would it have a meaning." Close quote. Now you may say, quote, "That may be true or may not be true," close quote. Certainly, if we judge in the abstract, we should be right. But if we look at the whole scene, and ask ourselves, quote, can we understand better what stands there when we take the version from the Akashic Records? Close quote. It will be apparent to everyone that this scene can only be understood in this way. We can say, too, that the last transcriber or translator of this passage did not understand the matter because it was difficult, and so wrote down what was inaccurate. He who knows how many things in the world are inexactly written down will not be surprised that here we have to do with an inexact version. Have we then no right, when a new epoch of humanity is beginning, to refer the Gospels again to the original form, which can be authenticated from the Akashic Records? The whole matter is plainly seen in regard to the Gospel of Matthew. And this case can be ratified even from external history. The best that has been said about the origin of the Gospel of Matthew may be read in the third volume of Blavatsky's title Secret Doctrine, a work which must be understood if we are to judge and value it correctly. There was a certain father of the Church, Jerome, who wrote toward the end of the 4th century. From what he writes, we learn something that can be fully confirmed by occult research, vis-à-vis that the Gospel of Matthew was originally written in Hebrew. In the copy that Jerome had obtained, or as we should perhaps say nowadays, in the version he possessed, he had before him the original language of this Gospel, written in the Hebrew letters still in use. But the language in which it was written was not the customary Hebrew. To Jerome, the task had been assigned by his bishop of translating the Gospel of Matthew for his Christians. Now, in regard to the translation, Jerome behaved in a most singular manner. In the first place, he thought it would be dangerous to translate this Gospel of Matthew as it was, because there were things contained in it which those who, up to that time, possessing it as their holiest writing, wished to keep from the lay world. He thought that this Gospel, if it were so translated, would cause disturbance rather than edification. So he omitted the things which, according to his own and the ecclesiastical views of that period, might have a disturbing effect, and replaced them by others. But we learn still more from his writings, and this is the most serious thing in the whole proceeding, namely that Jerome knew that the Gospel of Matthew could only be understood by those who were initiated into certain secrets. He knew, too, that he himself was not so initiated. In other words, he admitted that he did not understand this Gospel, yet he translated it. Thus the Matthew Gospel lies before us today in the dress given to it by a man who did not understand it, but who became so accustomed to this form that he afterward pronounced to be heresy whatever was asserted about the Gospel of Matthew, if it did not support what he himself had written. These things are absolute facts. The second point of interest, which we must examine, is the following. Why did those who held specially to the Gospel of Matthew, in the very earliest days of Christianity, communicate this Gospel of Matthew only to such persons as were initiated in the secret meaning of certain things? It is only possible to understand why this was so if we are theosophically somewhat familiar with the character of initiation. Such things have often been narrated to you in one connection or another, and you have specially been told that initiation, if by means of it a man attains clairvoyant power, leads him to gain possession of certain fundamental truths concerning the world. These fundamental truths about the world are such that, to the ordinary consciousness, they at first appear absurd. With such powers as man usually possesses, the ordinary consciousness can only say, in reference to the highest truths, that is a paradox. But more than that, if the highest truths, that is, those accessible to the initiate, were to be made known to an unprepared individual, either if he were to conjecture them, which in a certain case is possible, or if they were imparted to him when he was in an imperfect condition to receive them, even if they were the most elementary truths, they would be in the highest degree dangerous to the unprepared person. Even if the purest, the highest truth concerning the world were to be set before him, it would work destructively for him and for his surroundings. For this reason, he who today is in possession of the highest truths knows that it cannot be the right way merely to call someone to him and impart to him the deepest mysteries of the world. What are really the highest truths cannot be so imparted that a mouth simply pronounces them and an ear simply hears them. The way in which the highest truths are imparted is this. He who wishes to become a pupil is slowly and gradually prepared, and this preparation takes place in such a way that the last conclusion, the imparting of the mystery, does not pass from mouth to ear. At a definite point of time, the pupil, through preparation, is so conditioned that the secret, the mystery, rises up before him. It does not need to be pronounced by a mouth, nor does it need to be heard by an ear. It must be born in the soul through that which has taken place between teacher and pupil. There are no means of wringing from an initiate the last things of the mysteries, for no one can be compelled by any means on the physical plane to betray with his mouth anything of the higher mysteries. Thus it is with the higher mysteries. Further, if to anyone in an unripe condition that which should be born from the soul, as the higher mysteries must be, were to be communicated through the mouth of another, it would be full of danger to that other person also. For he who has imparted the knowledge would be given completely into the power of his hearer for the rest of his incarnation. This, however, is something which can never happen if the teacher simply prepares and the pupil allows the truths to be born from out of his soul. When we know this, we understand that the reason why the original Gospel of Matthew could not be imparted without further preparation was because men were not ripe to receive what was in it. For if Jerome, a father of the Church, was himself not ripe for what was contained therein, then certainly other men were not. Those who were originally in possession of these communications, the Ebionites, that's spelled Ebionites, Ebionites or Ebionites, did not impart these things because if received, let me read the sentence again. Those who were originally in possession of these communications, the Ebionites, did not impart these things because if received by unripe persons, they would have been so distorted that they must have led to what Jerome meant when he said that they would serve not for edification but for destruction. Now this Jerome understood, yet he allowed himself to impart in a certain way the Gospel of Matthew to the world. That is to say, this document has been imparted in a certain way and has had effect upon the world. Now if we look round and see how it has worked, then from occult truths we must find many things comprehensible. Who would be willing to grant, standing upon the ground of occultism, that all the persecutions, etc., in the Christian world could be connected with the principles of Christ Jesus himself? Who, standing on the ground of occultism, would not say that something must have flowed into external evolution which is not in accordance with Christian evolution? In short, a great misunderstanding must exist. There was a sentence, let me read it again. I'm going to start from there, sorry. Who would be willing to grant, standing upon the ground of occultism, that all the persecutions, etc., in the Christian world could be connected with the principles of Christ Jesus himself? Who, standing on the ground of occultism, would not say that something must have flowed into external evolution which is not in accordance with Christian evolution. In short, a great misunderstanding must exist. We mentioned in the preceding lecture how from this point of theosophical Christianity we should describe Apollonius of Tyana. We set before us the greatness and significance of this man. We called him an adept. Yet, when we go through the early Christian literature, we find everywhere accusations brought against Apollonius of Tyana, as though all that he had done, all that he had accomplished, had been accomplished only under the influence of the devil. There, we have something which must be called misrepresentation. Not only a misunderstanding of the personality and the acts of Apollonius of Tyana. That is only one thing among many. We understand only when we see that the Gospels have been handed down in a way that must needs lead to misunderstandings, and that at the present moment, on the ground of occultism, our task is to go back to the true meaning of Christianity, concerning which the first teachers made many mistakes. It will then appear comprehensible to us that the next epoch of Christianity will be experienced differently from the earlier epochs. It has already been said, however, that many things are stated here which can really only be said because the listeners have taken part in our theosophical development during the past few years, or because they are rightly disposed to inquire into our theosophical development. Persons in whose souls there is the corresponding feeling and mood which will allow what is imparted to work upon them. Because in reality souls have gone through at least one period of teaching, one incarnation, between the mystery of Golgotha and the present time, the Gospels can even now be spoken of today without fear that disaster may result. Thus we have before us the singular fact that the Gospels had to be communicated, but that Christianity could only be understood in its most imperfect form. The Gospels have consequently been subject to a mode of research which can no longer determine what is historical and what is not. And thus, finally, everything can be denied. That which is the original form must enter our hearts and souls. A new power will arise, whereby that which will now be presented to men can be accepted by those who have been able, worthily, to feel the events from the baptism of John to the event of Golgotha. Thus an interpretation of the Christ event from the occult standpoint is a necessary preparation for the souls that have in the near future to experience something new, souls that must look into the world with new faculties. The old form of the Gospels will first receive its true value through our learning to read the Gospels by means of that which alone gives them their real value, that is, by the help of the Akashic records. The true significance of the event of Golgotha can be fully demonstrated only by occult research. It is only when the original significance of this event is understood through occult research that the result for human souls can be experienced. As far as it is possible in one short course, our work in the following lectures will be to throw light upon all that the human soul can experience under the influence of the Christ impulse, so that we may attain thereby to a deeper knowledge that then hitherto was possible of that which happened in Palestine and on Golgotha. The end of Lecture 4.